cents for there, 1 cent and 2 cents. Mm-hmm. And the Sunday paper in Pittsburgh was only a dime. The customer used to buy more than one paper. Mm-hmm. He used to buy papers every couple
and
of hours.
People used to read more.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They used to buy papers when the baseball season was on. The first two innings and two more innings and all that. The extra, 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 you know, extra, because that's the only way they got the news. Now, when they got the news over the air, the news was
right,
wasn't interesting anymore. They knew it before they got the paper. So the circulation of the papers dropped, but the hometown paper never dropped. Every city, regardless of size, every community, even Squirrel Hill or Wilkinsburg or, mm-hmm. or you can Tradford, they have a local paper either once a week mm-hmm. or once, the biggest cities once a day. McKeesport's got a paper. They don't need it. The people live in McKeesport, and the paper is probably 50, 30 cents, 40 cents a day. They don't want to buy the Pittsburgh paper and the New York paper. Except the intellectuals, say an intellectual man, will not be satisfied to read and lives in Pittsburgh, will not be satisfied just to read the Pittsburgh Press. He'll buy the New York Times too, mm-hmm. or buy a big city paper. Mm-hmm. But you cannot do away with the hometown news. Mm-hmm. The hometown news will always be there. And
were you ever involved in the Jewish papers here, like the Jewish Chronicle?
Here?
Mm-hmm.
No, I was worked for Jewish papers in New York.
Right.
That's where I began.
But I didn't know if here you were ever involved in that.
Yeah. No, I knew the editors. Mm-hmm. It happens to me, I don't know, it happens that I'm the kind of person when I go to hear a speaker, I'll wind up talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go to... When I see other people talking, I'll join the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm not lonely.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you're driving at something. And mm-hmm. I forgot the point.
You know, you mentioned yellow journalism.
Well, those things don't exist anymore.
How did that?
Well, what they used to have is fake headlines. Like they have in the weeklies now, the yellow journalism is when you go in a food store and you see a bunch of news weekly papers, the Star and the,
mm-hmm.
what do you know the names?
Oh, you mean the sensationalism.
The sensationalism.
Like that's in the grocery store.
That's the word, sensationalism. And the first papers had big headlines and a lot of pictures, very little serious matter.
Mm-hmm.
Except on Sunday, and sometimes stories that were not too...
A little trashy.
A little bit.
How long did that continue, and how did it affect the rest of the papers that were in competition?
I don't know when it started, because when I came...
It was going on.
Those papers were already in existence. When I came to Boston, and the Hearst paper, the Boston... American, I think it was called, had a Jewish headline in red ink. Mendel Bailey's freed or something. It was a trial. They accused Mendel Bailey of killing a Christian boy to use his blood for baking matzah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that was 1912, 1913. And he died in New York eventually. This man for Bailey's. But his name became very, the whole trial was very famous all over the world. And I read up an awful lot on it. And
you mentioned Sacco Vanzetti.
Yeah,
Sacco
Vanzetti is a different...
That was later, right?
...different stage. That was an episode that hurt, that made me sit in a pew in a church, in the community church, while they were being executed.
Mm.
And I... Everybody was crying.
But the newspapers were also involved in...
Oh, that was a big story. Sacco Vanzetti, as a matter of fact, the Pittsburgh judge, Musmanna, a was involved in it very much. And so was my brother somehow involved in that. I don't recall how, but he was.
Was he a spokesman for them?
No. They were two Italians.
Yeah.
They had, in those days, they had anarchists, but not anarchists. Although there were some anarchists that threw bombs. There was a hail in Chicago. A lot of people got killed in the parade.
Haywood?
No, I forgot the Haymarket.
Haymarket.
Case. Oh, there was, history's full of that stuff. You take the Lindbergh baby case, and I worked on that in New York, selling papers. There were certainly, in those days, the papers played a part in all big things that happened in the world. Today, mm-hmm. The newspapers don't play such.
Like the television does now, like CNN and...
I think I told you the first time I met you, they sent me to New Kensington with 10,000 papers when Pearl Harbor Day on a Sunday. And I came there and nobody wanted to buy a paper. We heard it on the radio. We're going to get a paper tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't.
And they didn't buy.
10,000 papers, I don't think they sold 500. That's why they went out of business.
Mm-hmm.
The day of the newspaper is over except for local news.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't give, if you live in Pittsburgh, you wouldn't want to miss reading a daily paper here of what's going on in the city.
No.
No, you want your daily paper.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a little bit above the average,
you get the New York Times on
you'll
Sunday.
Get a bigger city.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And for people that live in Pitcairn, they get a Pitcairn, there is a paper in Pitcairn, a little mm-hmm. paper, once a week. But they also get the Pittsburgh paper. I'm not, we're straying away. What is there, any other question there?
Mm-hmm. Was there anything? Well, we were going to ask him about Chaim Levine.
Oh, right.
But wait.
And why is Chaim Weizmann out there?
Okay. Way back, that goes back to my, when I was a little boy, maybe 5 or 6. Before we talk about Chaim Weizmann, I want to tell you something strange. I must have been 9 or 10 years old. And I, together with another gang of boys who were 12 or 13, they said to me, come along. I went for them. They went up to in Yiddish, say a baby. What do they call under the roof, the place?
An attic.
We all went into an attic. And I followed them quietly. They sit down in a circle. How to overthrow the Tsar of Russia to make a revolution.
These little boys.
Children. Jewish children, all Jewish children.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and we went in there maybe about 10 or 12 of us.
Uh-huh.
And there was a leader, a little kid that was smarter than the others, to find out ways how to overthrow the Russian government.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. About my father was my mother was a business lady supporting the family. I told you that.
Mm-hmm.
She was in the store, the poor woman. And she had to worry about post-dated checks and buying and selling and collecting and keeping books and everything. My father, he was a politician. So the Dr. Herzl was the originator of the Zionist movement. Theodore Herzl.
Right.
Herzl is a street named after him in Brooklyn, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And the ideas caught on very strongly. And Chaim Weizmann lived in a town, I think it was called Mir. That time. And he became the traveling representative to spread Zionism. And he came to our city called Mosir,
mm-hmm.
a think I told you I saw it on television. And he came into the store. My father was known as a man who was a mix involved in the different parties. I came to my father because they probably asked somebody where to go. And he came in the store, and the store was full of customers. And my father, he was behind the counter usually. My mother was there. He dropped everything and started having a conversation with Chaim Weizmann. And my mother came and chased him out. She says, "Leave Don alone, Don, D-O-N, my father. He's busy now. Come back after 9 in the evenings. Come to the house." And I remember, and then we didn't know at that time he was going to be the first president of Israel, you see. And he was an inventor. He invented the powder, the gunpowder.
Oh, right? I didn't know that.
Huh?
I didn't know that.
He invented gunpowder?
Yeah, he invented the gunpowder. There's another name for it. He was the original inventor of gunpowder for shooting.
Did you ever see him again?
He's a chemist, I guess. I don't know how many times he came, but my father turned away from Zionism to territorialism.
Uh-huh.
And that was involved Galveston, Texas.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that became another movement, because to go to Israel at that time, there was no such thing as Israel, of course. And that would be probably the year 1906.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1907. Although, as little as I was, I remember those things. And right away, as soon, you know what happens to Jewish people, as soon as one has an opinion, it splits up into two, you see. And so there was the Zionist movement, and there was the people who believed the Jews don't need to go to Turkey or whatever they called it at that time. Eretz Yisrael, you see, the land of Palestine. And they don't have to go. It's too far away. They can get a territory. A territory could be any place, you know. Could be Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
The communists established a Jewish country in Siberia called Birobidzhan.
Really?
You never heard of it?
Mm-hmm. I have never heard of it.
Never heard of it?
I've never heard of
it. Mayor Bijan.
Birobidzhan. And they print Yiddish books there even now.
And they still live there?
Some do.
The settlement there?
Good many.
Very severe living standards.
Oh, I don't think it's
too bad.
As bad as they make it. It's, have you seen, I'm surprised that you've never heard of it.
Well,
it's
interesting.
Printed there, you see. That's right.
Why don't you go back to finishing with Galveston, though?
Yeah, the Galveston. All right. So there were two movements. One was with Dr. Herzl as the leader,
mm-hmm.
and although he died right away
mm-hmm.
at age 44.
Right.
And Dr. Herzl, but it caught on very strongly, the Zionist movement, and then there was the territorial movement. Territorialists.
Mm-hmm.
And that territory they picked happened to be Texas, being such a big state.
Right.
They figured the Jews can take over, get a part of the state of Texas, and go there and live in freedom on farms, on land,
mm-hmm.
not in the industry.
Right.
Industry to the Jews at that time wasn't even known. They were either peddlers or storekeepers, like my article.
Mm-hmm.
And the
In the Chronicle.
Last week said. And the Jewish people didn't work in coal mines, steel mills.
Right.
They didn't want it there. Didn't give them jobs there either. So even if they wouldn't go. Anyhow, that's the territory. The territory idea fizzled out. Didn't work out.
Did you know anybody who moved there?
I couldn't No, I don't think so, but I know that most of the Jews who live there now
are from
descendants of Jews that went there.
Right.
But they live in the big cities now. As a matter of fact, I think from there they went to Arizona. What was his name? Goldwater, his name. That was one of the families that originally went to Galveston, his grandparents or something. And others. Become famous department store.
Neiman Marcus, yeah.
German names.
Neiman Marcus, my name.
But that's a dead issue now. There's no. The Russians, the communists, did establish. That was after 1917. A home for Jews in. It's called it. It's not quite Siberia, but it's Siberia, and. What happened was that there's still some people there, quite a few. Peter Bijan. And that's a Jewish. You see, I.
Do you think the Communist Party was anti-Semitic or they were.
No.
Try to break that down.
No, the Communist Party originally was probably 95% Jewish to start with. You see, the first, after the Russian Revolution, there was a member named Kerensky, Vladimir Kerensky, and that was a very mild socialist idea. But Lenin was a communist, which is just like Orthodox Jews are different from Reform Jews. And communism is also socialism, but it's socialism as socialism with a dictatorship, because they didn't. Kerensky believed that socialism can come without bloodshed. Lenin believed you cannot establish real socialism without, you must have bloodshed, you must have, must do away with the capitalists and the rich people and the business people. And so he had a partner, Jewish partner, Trotsky. So Lenin and Trotsky were the leaders of Russia.
Trotsky was Jewish.
Oh yes, and how he lived in New York for quite a while. And so then something developed there in Russia, and Lenin died, and Trotsky fell out of favor. Trotsky was the head man of the Russian military army, the head general. So Trotsky was banned, and he ran away to Mexico. But I think it was Stalin or somebody that sent a man over there to work for him and gain his confidence, and then he took an axe and he killed him.
In Mexico, he?
The man, that, the Russian that worked as a porter, as a, what, not a porter, what do you call it? People who work.
Like a butler.
Butler. Worked for Trotsky, got his confidence, and Trotsky trusted him. Everything was all right. When everything was ready, the guy took out the axe. Anyway, I killed him.
He killed Trotsky.
Yeah, and that's the book, The Mind of an Assassin, that my brother wrote.
Mind of an Assassin?
Yeah. Rabbi Friel reviewed it to a terrific audience.
That sounds like a movie.
It's still at the good. I think it's still in the market. And that's the Trotsky story, the end of Lenin and Trotsky. Now that the time has come where even Lenin's statues are being demolished in Russia.
Right.
And I wish my brother was alive to see it. Given life, it's getting up too short.
Mr. Levine, how do you view your accomplishments and your successes? What do you view as the most significant accomplishment?
I don't believe that I have any accomplishments of any kind, except that I was able to survive as a to survive and provide for myself, for a wife, for 4 children in colleges, and I didn't become a rich man. I didn't accomplish anything except what's required by nature of a human being to reproduce. To reproduce, to keep the world going.
Mm-hmm.
I have grandchildren, I have children, and I get married, but I got married rather late, like I told you.
Uh-huh.
I was 35 or 36. Because I was wandering around, and things didn't come my way. It just, things, every, like I told you before,
mm-hmm.
things have to, I didn't live by plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I miss, and I still miss, the formal education. I think if I would have had a formal education, I could have, I think my head is working and I have ideas and I have a pretty good memory of, and I'm interested in everything that's going on in the world,
mm-hmm.
but I don't have the formal education to bring it out in writing like my brother had. He had an education, you see.
When he came over to the United States, to Boston, and you said he went to high school there, or was he, did you have relatives there that put him in school? And
well, he had.
Or on his own wits he did it.
Well, everybody had to be in his own wits.
Yeah. Right? But I mean, as a young boy, to be able to get to high school, was, would they go to night school?
I don't know. I don't think he went to night school. You see, we separated. The family always kept on separating. First we separated in Russia. One left for the United States in 1910,
mm-hmm.
1911, 1912. I came in 1913. Once we got here, we started separating again. One went to Kansas City and one went to other places. And my mother said, no, she's got to go in the grocery business. A landslide in New York, a landslide will be customers. And she opened up a grocery store on 11th Street, and the landslide were in the Bronx and in Brooklyn, and she didn't know that they couldn't come and buy a loaf of bread or a quart of milk all the way from the Bronx to downtown East Side, you see. And so the grocery went bad and all that. But then we're separate. And even now, there's only 3 of us left. One is in Brooklyn, one is in Boston, still in Boston, the original city, and I'm here. So that's the, maybe that's the course of all Jewish families.
Is there anything you would have done differently when you look over your life?
Well, I told you, I didn't care too much for schooling. I didn't like to be bothered and what day there was something took place in history. The date didn't matter to me. The thing that happened mattered to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember if somebody asked me, what date was Sacramento Mazzetti executed? That's what they teach you in school.
Mm-hmm.
The 4th of July was the revolution. We know that because of the man. I wasn't interested in the details. I was interested in the subject matter itself. And I was terrifically interested in almost everything that's happened since childhood. And there was an awful lot of things that happened in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with the Russian-Japanese War. And I think reading helped a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I used to sit in cafeterias and read books.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I read and cry. Some fiction books. Jacob Wasserman wrote some good books. You don't know, a German writer. I can't spontaneously name them writers I wrote. And I think even though maybe I didn't understand them so much, but they always touched me emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
You see, but I'm a woman across the hall yesterday knocked to my door, and I opened the door. I'm sick. It's not yours, Lucy Portman. Well, I took her by the arm. I said, what do you want to do? Want to go to the hospital? I don't know. I'm sick. I took her downstairs, and they called the paramedics and took her to the hospital. She had a bellyache. I understand they brought her back last night. And did you know that it choked me up? And I had tears in my eyes. But I am an emotion. Let's say something that developed in me that I can't, like you said, it beyond. I can't control it. And but that's, I don't consider it such a terrible ailment.
Mm.
I can live with it. I wipe my eyes and I, you know what I mean? I says, what have I got to do with her? What is she to me?
Mm.
Or there's an alarm, something happens, and it's exciting, it triggers me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's something that developed. Although, I don't know, it developed way back.
Is there anything special that you would like to add? You know, something that we have not asked or covered? Something that you feel is important about yourself that you would like to share with everybody? With the researchers that you think might be of interest?
Well, I would like to I don't know what to tell you about this. I would like to tell people that life is something they know. Life is short, and not to take it too serious.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, human beings are created in different, with different emotional standards.
Mm-hmm.
Some are very hot-headed and get awfully excited. They become communists. Or they become, Ku Klux Klan people, they become haters.
Mm-hmm.
Others are, have a milder character, and they will join milder forms of political parties and milder forms of religion is the same way. Some are so fanatical that they make it almost impossible to live.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very, the fanatical religious people, in my opinion, are very intolerant. Very intolerant people. And you take the medium synagogues and the people who believe in, I believe in God, but I am not, I'm not going to force it on anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But a man downstairs who moved in from Wharton, his name is Kaplan, and when he came in right away, he started, became a leader in the little synagogue here. And I don't want to go in there. I go to Beth Sholing or the other synagogues. He bawled me out, and he says, you're no good, and you two birds of a feather stick together. You and Heinstein, next door, there's a man who had a gun put to his head by the Nazis. And you know, a man like that is not so religious anymore. And so I took him to the Beth Shalom for Yisker, and he loved it. But this guy, Kaplan, is fanatical. So I believe that the human race is made up of different degrees of emotional excitement, or I know,
temperament.
Temperament. The temperament, yeah.
And those are kind of set in stone.
That's right. And there's always going to be difficulties and differences and all that.
Did you run into a lot of that when you've written a lot of letters to the editor over the years?
Whole book here,
right.
Yeah.
Did you ever get flack? Did you ever get problems because of some of the letters?
Yeah, I got some terrible letters, anti-Semitic letters.
Written to you at home from people you didn't know?
people I didn't know, and they didn't sign their names, and I got it right here. I wish you could only read one of them.
What made you write all the letters that you did?
What made me write? When mm-hmm. I think of... I only write when I feel like writing about something. This letter in the Chronicle was a personal experience. And...
So when something affects you, that's when you write it?
No, it isn't only it affects me. The anti-Semitic letters, something terrible.
What were they in reference to? What kind of letters had you written?
Huh?
What kind of...
I wrote a letter about... with President John Kennedy's wife,
uh-huh.
That she married a man with a lot of money, you know, Greek, and somebody, I don't know, this letter brought anti-Semitic responses.